Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
We have a lot of these incoming members, three or four at least on the Republican side, that have told us flat out they're not going to vote for a farm bill no matter what's in it. And these are members from ag states.
Ethan Lane is with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
It's going to be a big education lift to help them understand the importance of the farm bill, the benefit that the farm bill provides to producers. And, you know, the cattle industry is in a different spot than other parts of agriculture. We don't have large-scale programs, price support programs or subsidy programs to protect in this bill. We're focused on voluntary stuff. We're focused on voluntary conservation programs, and we're focused on voluntary risk management programs and, tools like that. But nevertheless, those are important tools for our producers. So we're going to have to make sure we're in there really aggressively educating about the benefits of this bill and why it's so important to rural America.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The first number to highlight from the January crop production annual summary was a very large, by historical standards, drop in the harvested acres for the 22 crop.
Dr. Scott Irwin is a University of Illinois ag economist. Looking back at the latest USDA WASDE report,
it dropped 1.6 million acres between November estimate and January. So we had that drop, and we did have a corresponding one bushel increase in the yield per acre, so that the impact on the corn market wasn't as severe as you might think with a 1.6 million acre drop. It dropped by about, production dropped by about 200 million bushels, so that we did have a little less supply than we anticipated before the January numbers came out. And so you can see that our numbers, the FarmDoc 22-23 numbers are basically, are exactly the same as what the USDA is carrying on their latest WASDE forecast.
He also breaks down the stock's usage numbers.
Also, equally interesting news going on with the on the use side. A lot of interesting things going on. The USDA, in their January WASDE numbers, actually lowered, Joe, the feed and residual number by 25 million bushels. And you'll see that we are actually arguing that we should increase it 50 million bushels above the USDA's Jan number, and actually an increase over and above where it was in the December WASDE. And I'll jump down here to where that comes from. This is the implied usage surprise for corn in that DEIS 1 grain stocks report. So this takes into account the difference between what the market expected for first quarter marketing year use, total usage of corn, after we have to adjust for the smaller corn crop. So you have to take that 200 million bushels into account. And basically, it said that total usage of corn in the first quarter was 141 million bushels larger than what the trade was expecting. And just kind of a rule of thumb, the way Joe and I approach this is that, roughly speaking, there's a lot of variation quarter to quarter. So, you know, kind of fade that in your estimates by half. So you could look at that 141 bushels and say, you would raise your feed and residual by 70 million would be kind of the ordinary procedure. But this is a pretty unusual situation where the USDA chose to go down in the face of that bullish supply data point. And we're going to stick with the data, and that's why we're raising our feed and residual estimate compared to the USDA by 50 million. So that's what's going on there.
But if you like to jump into the deep end like a cannonball, you might want to rethink that strategy.
This is very unusual for them to lower feed and residual use in the face of that kind of bullish information. And so we are keeping ours really cautious compared to the size of that surprise, and definitely something we want to really watch carefully going forward, particularly with possible macroeconomic recessionary trends. Maybe this is just a statistical blip. We'll find out.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So our group gets together about three times a year, one for a board meeting in the fall, one for our annual conference that we just finished up in San Diego in early December. That meeting went really well.
Darren Kopic is CEO, Ag Retailers Association.
And then this meeting that we're coming up on in early February, where we do a board meeting here in Washington, but the real center of attention is a congressional fly-in that we organize. And so we'll have the people on the board. We also have members that aren't on the board, but they just come to D.C. because they love the fly-in. So our team, in fact, we're registering people right now, getting teams assigned, and they'll break them up into different regions. And so we might have a Kansas, Oklahoma, Nebraska group. We might have an Illinois, Iowa group, just based on who's coming. And so our team will set up those appointments. We brief our team, all the teams that are going out. And in the past, we've done about 130 congressional visits in one day in this format with everybody involved. So it's a huge undertaking for us and for the team, but it's a great day, one that people really enjoy. And it's important to get in front of these members, especially the new ones, to make sure they know what our needs and priorities are and who we are.
So what are the ag retailers' legislative priorities?
The big thing that most of the ag people are talking about right now is the Farm Bill. That's up for reauthorization this year, and it's important to get it done. Thankfully, some other priorities got completed in 22 so that we can focus our efforts in this area for 23. And for us, we're really trying to support farmers, you know, across the board. So we're trying to preserve crop insurance, trying to maintain CRP acres at the current cap, and emphasize working lands in some of these conservation programs so that we're not setting aside resources, but we're using the ones that we have in a better way. We're trying to engage on some sustainability and carbon credit issues. And one of the interesting questions is the Inflation Reduction Act that happened last December included a bunch of money for Farm Bill programs. But what we don't know is whether that new money is going to be included in the baseline that the committees use to write these bills, or whether the baseline is just the stuff that normally happens in the Farm Bill and does not include the Inflation Reduction Act figures. And unfortunately, we've not heard from the budget hawks yet what that answer is. It'll have a significant impact on what the final bill looks like.
And what else besides the Farm Bill?
Transportation is always at the top of that list. One of the things we're working on right now is something called the Trucks Act that would allow states to issue waivers from DOT's entry-level driver training requirements that just went into effect last year. Some of those are fairly onerous requirements, especially with strained staff at the state level. And so if states can selectively offer exemptions or waivers from that ELDT training, we think that would really help with the available driver pool of drivers. We're constantly looking for ways to expand the hours of service provisions that would to make it more flexible for agriculture, extend out the mileage radius on the ag exemption. We're successful in getting some seasonal CDL reforms done last year. And the other piece in transportation that I think is pretty interesting is it looks like we're actually going to be able to move the ball with the Surface Transportation Board on some rail issues for shippers this year. And in fact, the chair of the STB is going to come to our board meeting on February 8th and spend a half an hour with us talking about shipper issues. So a lot of the transportation area, we're also looking at some ag labor and workforce issues, energy, safety and security. So no shortage of issues to work on behalf of the membership.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Box beef cutouts last week showed some weakness. They were down about $5 week on week.
Bob Maurer is a market analyst and a broker with Manduca Trading in Chicago, taking a look at last week's cattle markets.
Cash live cattle prices were, if you look at the 5-day, 5-area weighted moving average for cash live cattle prices, they were down about, say, $1.40-ish, something like that. So both the box beef numbers were down, and then also the cash price was down. Slaughter was also down. Last week's number was estimated at 646,000 head. That's down from 661 the previous week. So we want to continue to see the slaughter numbers stay at these heightened levels. And especially because we want to see continued throughput in terms of the processors, that being the packers. So that's an indication of the demand from them. And then in terms of the export sales, kind of a, you know, give and take. If you look at the U.S. beef export sales for the week ending Jan 12, they came in at about 17,000, just shy of 17,300 metric tons, and that was up from 13,330 the previous week. So pretty good uptick there just in the one-week basis for the week. But cumulatively for 2023, we've reached about 174,500 metric tons down from about 257. So week-to-week, good, but you know, keeping score through this year so far, and we're, you know, it is what it is, but it, you know, so far, it's not looking so good. So we need to see that to turn around, pretty quick. And I think that the fact that China was one of the major buyers, I think the fact that they're coming back online, after the holiday there that they celebrate, then I think hopefully that bodes well and those numbers can, turn around there. Also, another perspective looking at the cattle markets is just the overall tendency. So one of the tools I use in my arsenal when trying to make decisions and for the hedgers out there and also look for opportunities for speculators is just the seasonal tendencies. And nothing works all the time. Trust me, I know that really good. But April feeder cattle have a bullish tendency between Jan 31 and Feb 16, so 80%. Of the years out of the last 15 years, there's been a bull move in that about 2 week window beginning the end of this month. And then June live cattle, they also have a bullish tendency between Jan 29 and Feb 19. It's a little bit longer window by about 3 or 4 days. And again, it's about a success ratio of about 87% over the last 15 years. So China showing up in terms of export sales, that's good. Hopefully that continues. Look at the tendencies in terms of placements numbers that we talked about and how if this year tracks last year, then the numbers are going to just probably continue to decrease, which would set up a more bullish scenario. We already know about the seasonal side of the supply side of the equation. So that's a bullish scenario. And then we add the seasonal tendency and that's a bullish scenario. So it looks to me like, you know, the market is in good shape, like I said, over the next 3 to 6 months. A lot of things can happen that could turn that around quickly, but, you know, I like the way the market's looking.
Iowa State livestock economist Lee Schultz adds,
I've started to see some chatter about raising some more replacement females or purchasing some more replacement females. And so I think that's where the start of this article really highlighted is, you know, I think we need to start thinking about it. And if you're starting to think about it, those heifers may be undervalued kind of currently in this market because of the such high cost. So as an individual producer, if I have the opportunity to buy some replacements or I'm thinking about it, now might be the time because I think they're going to get a lot more expensive as we start to see calf prices really escalate.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
For those of you who haven't been focused on it, I hope you'll get on our website, energy.gov/BIL for bipartisan infrastructure law, to figure out, you know, if you're eligible to attend. We have some upcoming webinars for more information.
Jennifer Granholm is Secretary of Energy at the Department of Energy. She was speaking recently to the U.S. Conference of Mayors in New York City promoting clean energy.
An important part of the application is an energy efficiency and conservation strategy that asks you to lay out your visions and your goals. We want to see if you have big, hairy, audacious goals, how y'all are thinking big, and you can apply today if you're ready, but you've got time if you need it, because the deadline isn't until a year from now, actually, but we want to help you get through the application process. So the best thing about EECBG Energy is what you've been telling us, which is its flexibility. Maybe you want to use these funds to develop a clean energy strategy with measurable goals. I'm all about measurements. Maybe you want to conduct energy audits. Maybe you want to make streetlights more efficient. Maybe you want to install renewable energy on government buildings. Maybe you want to fund a community solar campaign. Your call. This program is built around the principle that communities know what works best for them, so they should be in the driver's seat on the road to our clean energy future. Because what works, obviously, in Wichita might not work in Walla Walla, and Tallahassee might want something different than Toledo. And that means our role here at the Department of Energy is really to add resources, to provide tools, and to offer help in helping you achieve your goals.
And what does it mean to be place-based? Granholm explains.
the principles at the heart of really, we've got this tremendous emphasis now on place-based initiatives at DOE from our work with communities that are experiencing economic impacts from the energy transition to our investments in tribal energy independence and resilience. So that's EECBG.
And she charged the mayors with helping the Department of Energy to roll out these programs.
We're in the middle of implementing, right, the most significant climate and clean energy legislation in history. We want to get these funds out the door as quickly as we can, but we need to get it right, which means we need to hear your ideas. And this is particular to the Inflation Reduction Act's home energy rebate and building code programs, right? All of the stuff you've been hearing about rebates, we need to get it right. It's a $9 billion initiative. It's intended to help families, obviously, install energy efficient and electric technology in their homes, like heat pumps, induction stoves, save them hundreds of dollars a year, maybe even hundreds of dollars a month. So even though this funding itself is going to go through states and tribes, you're going to be where the rubber meets the road. If you want to start an initiative to get heat pumps in people's homes, it's the cities that are going to make that happen. You're the ones closest to your residents. So I hope that by March 3rd, you accept the invitation to tell us what you think is needed to get it right. And that, I hope you'll use our office. We have a new Office of State and Community Energy Programs, SCEP. Love the acronyms, right? All through the federal government. It's true at the state and local level, too. But SCEP, State and Community Energy Programs, and our Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, that's the door to get into sharing your feedback on all of DOE's programs and how to access them.
Secretary of Energy, Jennifer Granholm. And this is Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think one of the things we have to do is the way our organization is really set up is we have to really focus on the longer term. You know, we can't necessarily deal with some of the short-term events.
Barry Worsham is president and CEO of Cotton Incorporated.
Longer term, some of the things that are happening, I think there was going to be a shift, continued shift out of China in terms of a manufacturing base into other countries, whether that's India, Pakistan, Vietnam, Bangladesh, maybe a little bit back to the Americas. So, you know, we have to be nimble as an organization to be able to continue to know where the business is going and how we're going to address that. You know, the cotton that we have that we grow in the U.S., about 80% of it is exported. Maybe that's even more. Well, it depends on the year, but about 80% is exported. So we have to, you know, have to be aware that if you want to create additional demand for cotton, then you've got to be working in international markets. The other thing is to look for opportunities. And sustainability is something that potentially could be an opportunity for cotton, and particularly U.S. cotton. You know, the synthetics have their issues with the microplastics that continues to gain air time, or at least space, in terms of awareness, a negative awareness on the synthetics. And cotton's a natural fiber, so that and combined with some of the programs that are out there now to kind of elevate U.S. cotton through the U.S. Cotton Trust Protocol, that gives us a potential, you know, way of, in the longer term, as this issue continues to grow in importance, to position cotton in a better light and perhaps claw back some of the market share that we lost in some of the other. But we have to, as part of that, you know, when I started years ago, maybe you could just market your way to stronger demand. But now that has to be backed up with products that we can compete. And, you know, our R&D team needs to continue to develop technologies and environmentally safe technologies so that cotton can perform with the synthetics in some of the key markets. And, you know, that's something we're doing. And maybe not even last, but there's many other things. But another thing is we've got to continue to have a message, positive message about cotton to the consumer, and you know, that people still think of cotton as something good and not let that, you know, some of the negatives out there in the competition cause that to change. So we want to take advantage of our assets. We're a natural product. We've got a sustainability story, and we want to continue to get that out there despite the, you know, the waves, the economic and the and the weather variations that are going on. So it's almost like you got to look over the horizon in our company.
Kevin Brinkley is president and CEO of Plains Cotton Cooperative Association on the latest out of China.
China actually acknowledged that their population is starting to decline. And this was probably not supposed to happen until around 2030, according to demographers around the world. But China has got an aging population like most of the developed world does. And this is going to be a real issue for them. Think about this. They instituted the one-child policy in 1980. They've got at least three generations of a lot of population missing because of that policy. And they do not have these institutional support systems for their seniors like we do with the Social Security system for all of its ups and downs. You have actually the current generation is working to support those who are retired. So you have one grandchild supporting four parents and potentially more grandparents than that, depending on how many of those are living. So that is a lot of pressure on the current workforce in China.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
All eyes are on South America. I mean, I think if I remember right, Argentina's crop condition showed 5% of their crop in the good to excellent categories.
Bob Maurer with Manduca Trading in Chicago.
There's a hyper-focus on what's happening down there. And over the weekend, a front moved through Argentina, and a lot of areas received anywhere from about 3/4 to 1.5 inches. So that's good. Another couple of fronts are expected to move through there this week. So definitely there's an outlook for better weather. And this is just what the market's supposed to do when things turn friendlier in terms of development. You know, the market is supposed to, you know, in quotes, move lower and adapt to those prices. And I just don't know with a 5% good to excellent that a little rain here and there, that was decent rain actually, but that's enough rain to really turn the tide. But at least in the market psychology, it was enough to put some pressure into the market today. And if corn and soybeans are going to react anywhere from, you know, 9 to 15 cents lower, then I would imagine wheat's going to fall along too. And that's exactly, in my opinion, what happened there. Now, in terms of, you know, wheat in specific, the farm futures came out. We're getting some private, you know, publications from private entities of what their expectations in terms are in terms of wheat acreage going forward and the other crops going forward. And Farm Futures Survey put out their estimate for total wheat acres in 2023 may increase about 7% to about 48.8 million. And if that's realized, it would be one of the largest crop stones since 2016. So that is a bearish element that's worked its way into wheat. And I know we mentioned export sales, which have been, you know, bittersweet in terms of cattle. We talked about that, but also that we're watching those numbers in grains. And for wheat, the cumulative sales have reached about just shy of 74% of USDA's forecast for this marketing year. Five-year average is about 76.4. So we're trailing by about 3 percentage points or so. And then about the same story for corn, where cumulative sales are lagging the USDA's number for this time of year. The only bright spot is soybeans, where it's actually a little bit higher. So put all that together, and today we've got to move lower. And again, you know, I imagine that if the weather turns unfriendly again down in Argentina, some of these prices that some of these moves that we've seen to the downside recently are going to reverse at least halfway back. So we'll keep an eye out for that to happen.
But what could the new year hold for cotton? Mark Brown's with Plains Cotton Growers.
If we think about the challenges that we had last year, unfortunately, I think a lot of those challenges are going to persist. Currently, we still have this La Nina weather pattern, and we're still extremely dry out here. The wheat is needing a drink, and we certainly need to put some subsoil moisture into the full moisture profile, and hopefully we'll get some of that rain later on this winter and into the spring months. But weather outlook is always going to be a given in terms of challenges out here on the high plains. We're still looking at rather high input prices and uncertainties on availability of some of those inputs. We're also looking at continued labor shortages. So I wish that I could tell producers that this year is going to be a whole lot easier than last year, and hopefully the weather will cooperate much better than it did last year. But I do know that just like any other year out here on the high plains, it's going to come with many challenges for our producers.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Our nation's produce industry, fruits, vegetables, and other specialty crops, is highly labor-intensive on the farm level. Yet, as USDA economic researcher Skylar Simnett explains,
there's a general consensus in the U.S. right now that domestic farm workers are getting harder to find. As evidence of that, the farm wage rate is increasing faster than the non-farm wage rate for non-supervisory positions. When supply is not keeping up with demand, you end up with a higher equilibrium price, which in that case is the wage rate. So we find that growers, particularly in the produce industries, are affected by this. And that's because their products are labor intensive, and also a larger share of their total cost expenditures, as you'd think, would go to labor.
As a result, growers are looking into other production and management strategies to offset rising labor costs, some short term, others at a longer range of time. Examples range from using existing mechanical aids to developing new and improving existing technologies. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.